Designers in Film, presented by Mike Dempsey.
If you've seen Fight Club, Minority Report, The Terminal, Corpse Bride, or Watchmen, then you will have experienced just a sampling of my guest's special contribution to the world of cinema. Alex McDowell is one of the most sought-after production designers working today. He has forged a real point of difference in the overhyped world of movie making with his unique, immersive, narrative approach to production design. He doesn't build sets, he builds worlds. Worlds where everything has a unique relationship to the story, giving far more scope and flexibility to the director, and is akin to the Stanislavskian method school of acting, where the actor is required to create a complete history for a character in order to inhabit them truthfully. McDowell's method of production design has attracted some of America's leading directors, from Steven Spielberg to Tim Burton and Terry Gilliam to David Fincher. He also evangelizes about his approach to world building via his 5D network, a high-caliber interdisciplinary think tank highlighting new technologies in design fields. I spoke to Alex when he was on a recent visit to the UK from his home in Hollywood. We started at an earlier chapter in his life that connects him with the birth of punk while studying painting at Central School of Art back in the mid-70s. It was here that his year-end show was censored and removed from the public gaze. I asked him the reason why this had happened.
We were in an odd year, I think, or an odd phase, where the teachers had come in from sort of 60s abstraction, and we were a bunch of figurative artists for whatever reason, almost the whole group of us in the year that I joined. So we started off in a sort of place of tension in the school at Central. And I think I seem to remember our first introduction was them basically saying, you know, welcome to Central, you will never get a job, see you in 3 years. And it was very, you know, there was no real sort of pop art energy in the air or anything. We were in this sort of slump middle years. So I think that to some extent contributed to my urge to sort of be noticed. And ultimately, I think my only sort of step towards a sort of fine art statement was to push the limits and see how much shock was a factor in subject, you know, in this figurative space. So I don't think I was really a painter at all. I really got accepted for my drawing skills. And I had done, you know, life drawing since I was 15 or 16 at school, and really was fairly adept in kind of figurative drawing. But as a painter, I think I was just much more interested in the sort of sociopolitics of chaos and misbehavior. So I sort of worked my way through various subjects, sexual and the punk thing was going on, and there was a sort of saying, well, how far could things be pushed? And I was looking at the actionists, the sort of Swiss actionists, and sort of blood-based performance and Chris Burden, and what got my show pulled down was a couple of things. It was a giant drawing that I did with, I think the subject was an execution. And another big drawing, the main thing, was a portrait, full size, of a young man on his back shitting into another man's mouth. And so that seemed to sort of strike it was called Coprophilia, F-I-L-L-Y-A. That was the subject, and we set it up, and it was kind of performed. If I'd known anything about, if I'd had the sort of perspective of YBA.
Interestingly, that those topics have been covered, you know, subsequently over the years by Gilbert and George very explicitly. So it's kind of interesting that, and also if you think about Andy Warhol's silt screens of electric chairs and car crashes, it seems strange that they would have removed your efforts, but yeah, I suppose that was there. The other interesting thing at that time that I want to touch on is you met Glenn Matlock, the bass player of the Sex Pistols, and you were, I think, the social secretary of Central at that time, and you were responsible for booking the Sex Pistols in 1975.
Six, I think. Yeah, I think in 76. It was early. Yes, I was in the student union and I'd got cajoled by the previous year's student union social secretary to take this on. And really, it was just the regular standard sort of who could we afford kind of booking of bands. And then a young man came in off the street into the student union and said, do you want a band to play for free tomorrow night, mate? And I said, absolutely, come on in. And so I went to see them that night and he said, come see us play. And they played at St. Martin's in supporting a band called Bazooka Joe and got kicked off the stage by the main act. So they came the next night and played their first full gig at Central. And it was, you know, it was life-changing stuff when you saw...
Now, that's interesting you should say that, because another RDI that I've interviewed, a long-term friend of yours, Malcolm Garrett, said that that punk changed his life. I mean, that it was the ism that he was looking for, and nothing was the same after that. So what is it about the Sex Pistols in particular that changed things for you? In what way?
Well, it was, you know, no question it was this assault, you know. You had this fantastic in-your-face attitude just being projected. So it was very compelling. John Lydon was completely charismatic. The band had, you know, a sense of energy and anarchy around them, which was very attractive. And I think that we were all looking for something. You know, we were all looking for some sort of focus. I think in the larger socio-political context, the reason the Pistols took when they took, you know, and Malcolm had tried this before and it hadn't taken with New York Dolls, I guess, and sort of 2 or 3 years earlier. But the time was right, you know, it was in the air, and everyone, I think, was really antsy musically. You know, you had disco and old rock and roll, and that's where we were gravitating towards, kind of rock and roll, wearing drape jackets and sort of doing that. And then suddenly...
And there was also this this period of groups getting overproduced and being ridiculous with these sort of long, extended albums that went on with drum solos that went on for about half an hour, or guitar solos. And this seemed... That was completely antidote to all of that. It was rough, ready, and in your face. And
yeah.
It was, you know, sticking two fingers up to everyone.
And it was something to which one could instantly belong. You know, we were immediately that one looked around the room and saw who was attracted to this. Yeah. You were a gang, you know, and that's what it's really all about, isn't it? I think so. You know, I stayed in touch. I got in touch with Malcolm and said, basically, is there anything I can do to help? And I want to stay.
Well, that takes me on to your link with Vivian Westwood and designing, I think, the T-shirt Destroy, that T-shirt. And you also designed the interior for a shop.
Yes, I didn't design it, but I was there as a sort of design factotum in a way for them. So while Jamie Reed was doing a lot of the graphic work with the album covers, and at some point asked me to sort of join him as an assistant in his graphics business. But prior to that, I was really doing whatever I could. I started off doing photography with them and went to some amazing gigs, Chalet du Lac in Paris, you know, sort of legendary, and Manchester. But I was just a horrible photographer and I wasn't exposing the film, you know, and it was stupid. We totally blew it. But Vivian wanted somebody to print T-shirts for the shop for Sex that was transitioning into seditionaries.
Yeah.
So we set up with our resources and, you know, a good team of people who knew quite a lot about printmaking from Central, we set up a screen printing shop in Hackney and really just started turning it out. I mean, I think it was probably a year after we'd first seen the band by then. And then I was working with Vivian assembling screens and, you know, we printed all the classics and put together the Destroy T-shirt, totally working under Vivian's direction, but doing lots of that. And then I think at the point when she and Malcolm made seditionaries, they wanted material content for the walls. And so we printed using the resources we had. We printed huge sheets of photographic negative images of Dresden for the walls. Yeah. So Ben Kelly was doing the exterior and I was doing that for the interior.
Was that sort of your first interior project in a way?
Yes, it was really.
I thought you talked about going on various gigs, and there's one in particular. We're in a Jubilee year, as you know, and there's going to be a pageant on the Thames. And back in 77, there was another little pageant on the Thames, and that was what was now Notorious. And I actually watched it on YouTube. Actually, it's on YouTube. This boat trip with the Sex Pistols, which ended up with, I think, everyone being arrested by the police. And you can see the police launch coming up. There seemed to be a lot of people, and they all seemed to be slightly out of control. How was that?
There was the whole atmosphere in London at the time. I think there might have been 200 or 300 punks in London. You know, it was a tiny group, but it was, wherever it landed, it was extremely categoric. You know, you were there, and it was you know, you against everybody. And the boat trip, for whatever reason, it was just another one of those things to show up to, really. But obviously, fantastic bit of performance art, just sailing down the river playing God Save the Queen outside of the House of Parliament.
I know.
And it was all a great laugh, you know, but the cops, the police really obviously had been instructed to shut it down, pulled us over. Everyone, you know, it was a bar on the boat. Everyone was completely drunk, I'm sure. And then one by one, they were pulling people into the Black Marias.
And is that where you ended up?
Yeah, I think a large part of the corps spent the night in the Clink.
So later, when you left college, you formed a design group or company called Rocking Russian Design, and you went on to create record covers and more T-shirts, and even employed, I think, a young Neville Brody.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that era. Now you're really concentrating on really designing album covers and supporting material.
Yeah, well, I think two significant things happened. One, having really made good friends with Glenn Matlock from that point of the first meeting the Pistols, and then as he fell out of favour with the band, left, that was the point at which it was sort of stay with the Pistols and work with Jamie or go with Glenn, and he invited me to go with to help him set up whatever he was going to do next.
Yeah.
And so we travelled around the country, and I was there helping him recruit band members for the Rich Kids, which was his next project. And as that started to materialise, they needed record sleeves. And so Glenn invited me to do the sleeves for the band, but in order, obviously there was only a certain amount of work there. And he invested in this design studio so that we could design for him, but we could also then start designing for other bands. And having met a lot of people through Glenn, that started moving quite rapidly. We were doing a lot of different record sleeves quite quickly.
So what sort of period of time that was Rocking Russian Design established for?
Well, I think I would say probably 78, I think. State Arts was the T-shirt printing, and then that migrated into Rocking Russian. But the biggest sort of design influence, and I think the reason that it sort of, where Rockin' Russian all came together, was Terry Jones.
Yeah, of ID Magazine.
Of ID Magazine,
and
yeah.
You were involved with that as well to an extent.
Yeah, Terry came to my final show, saw the show pulled down, or pre-pulled down, and was doing a book called The Pink Punk Book, and asked me to come and contribute some pages. And he wanted one of my paintings in there, and I ended up laying out a lot of it and writing some text. And it's kind of really one of my favorite books of that era. It's hard to get hold of now. So I was kind of starting to work with Terry, and really was the first graphic designer I'd ever come in contact with, because my whole space had been about fine art. And he really became a mentor. And as he was making this transition, I can't quite remember the order of events, but he had just left British Vogue to make a fanzine. I mean, it was a fantastic, bold, brave leap that he made, and invited myself and a writer called Perry Haynes to get involved as editors on this magazine called ID. And it was literally made as a fanzine. There was a badge maker and Portobello Road called Etterbadge, and we went there, and he printed Sniffing Glue and a lot of the fanzines, all the young poets and various printed zines. And so we put ID through that gene, basically, using badge printing machines, you know, mm-hmm. sort of almost mimeographed. And the first three, I think, were basically monochromatic, mm-hmm. you know, sort of red cover and black photos. But all of the components of ID were really in place, you know, mm-hmm. the stand-up, the going and stopping people in the street. It was a brilliant concept. And so I learned a lot about graphics working with Terry.
And then shortly after that, or maybe around the time, you started to get involved more with pop promos, or at least art direction to a certain extent. We're moving towards now what eventually would become far more important. So how did that transition start from printed graphics, writing for the magazine, and then moving into actually being more involved with the look of things within pop promos? How did that transition happen?
The record sleeves became more and more involved, and one started doing the packaging, the marketing, basically, of tours. And I was working on Iggy Pop's Soldier album and campaign, which also had come about because Glenn was playing with him, playing bass for Iggy's band at that point. And so I met him. And eventually, having done this campaign graphics and been involved with Iggy for probably about 6 months around that, both the album and the touring, he said, did we know anyone who could make a music video? Because they were just starting to happen, and he was interested in having one. And we said, oh, we'll do it. Not really knowing what on earth it meant or involved or anything. And I knew one person at film school, young director called Nick May, and knew he had a camera, and had been working with Brian Griffin, the photographer, on the album cover. Mm-hmm. And so we went to Brian's studio with Nick on the camera and myself sort of gathering props, and filmed three or four minute videos for Iggy for £3,000. Mostly completely abstract. I mean, one of them is him sitting inside a fridge singing Dog Food, I think. And so they were just, it was really just an extension of the relationship. But it was really fun. And fairly soon after that, I met a young director called Tim Pope, who was working with a production company that was more or less opposite Rocking Russian on Berwick Street. And we just ran into each other. And he had been doing political training videos and had been asked whether he'd like to direct music videos.
Let's just talk about the Cure video in particular, because that was used probably your smallest set, which was a wardrobe. Tell me a little bit about that.
This was this very interesting time where the record companies really were out of contact with the bands. The whole development of punk had created this kind of tension between music business and the bands, and we found ourselves in this interesting position of becoming almost translators between the two. And because of that, and I think really significantly for the rest of my kind of career to date, we found ourselves empowered to have this direct relationship with the content, really. The bands would say, as in the case of Robert Smith with the video for The Cure, would say the song's about claustrophobia. And then Tim Pope and I would go off into a room and think for a couple of days and come up with ideas, but we'd not present them really to the record company. We'd really just present them back to the band, and the band would approve it. So it was kind of the lunatics running the asylum. Mm. And the wardrobe video was the band inside a wardrobe that we built that was just sort of 10% larger than the regular wardrobe, built so that all the walls came off. So it was a little narrative machine, but I think it's probably the smallest set ever built. Mm. And with a very simple storyline of the wardrobe falling off a cliff and the band drowning.
And that made quite an impact on that scene, which obviously brought you to the fore in terms of pop promos. And you then went off to LA, where you continued in that area and worked for quite a large number of artists, including Madonna. And then you moved into commercials as well, meeting various people, including David Fincher. Obviously, that enabled you to meet quite a lot, a whole new range of people, being in the centre of filmmaking. And, you know, quite understandably, you moved on to to being involved in your first feature, which was Lawnmower Man in 1992. How did that happen?
There was a couple of really powerful production companies in LA. One was Limelight, that was actually British owned, and the company that I came over to the States working for. And then the other was Propaganda, and I started working with David Fincher. Did a sort of solid year of 7 day weeks working with David. And somewhere in the middle of that, he made the transition from music videos to commercials. And of course, we all transitioned with him. And those the success in commercials for these directors really drew the attention of the studios. And so the studios started looking to this new wave of filmmakers.
And it's interesting that, because if I think probably 10 years before that in this country, it was obviously the Ridley Scotts, the Hugh Hudsons and the Alan Parkers who came from advertising and commercials that were being suddenly recognised as being filmmakers that had a different vision, particularly the look of films. And America didn't actually catch up until a little bit later. So it's quite interesting that they found their directors coming out of pop promos, which of course Ridley Scott and Parker and those were not involved with. So the two new areas really sort of rejuvenating cinema. So after those commercials, you managed to get into Lawnmower Man on that first project, and that led you on to, after a couple of years, because I think you then moved back into commercials rather than being typecast. Yep. After doing your first film, moved back into commercials, and then up popped The Crow in 1994. That was the beginning of your road in filmmaking, which I think to date I counted 20 films. Ooh. That you've been involved with, one of which as co-producer. Before we go on to those, the important films that you have been applauded for in particular, let's just quickly whiz back to your childhood. You were born in Borneo. How come?
My father was an engineer for Shell, and Shell would move their people on every 4 years or so. So my dad was moving from country to country, met my mother in Borneo, where I was born, and then went back to Holland for a little bit, and then to Indonesia. So I mostly grew up in Indonesia until I was seven, and then I went to boarding school.
Really a bit like a military family.
I think so,
very,
yeah.
Similar sort of background, where you would end up in this country at boarding school and your parents would be posted to wherever.
Yeah.
Being at boarding school from seven presumably made you fairly self-reliant, really, sort of.
Yeah, I think boarding school has a couple of effects. I mean, they were single-sex schools, so you have this, you're in this very closed system and you have to survive. And it wasn't like Eton or it was actually, they were Quakers run by kind people who you know, took care and weren't allowed to, corporal punishment, so it was actually kind of great. But they're highly competitive and you have to be completely self-reliant. And I think that combination of living up abroad, growing up abroad and having a very skewed perspective on Britain and on being British, and then coming into the middle of this closed system and being both competitive and self-reliant. I think all of those things have been important in the way that I function.
When did you start to find your kind of creative inclinations? When did they start to surface?
I think, as sometimes happens, I think I had a teacher who was highly supportive. I think around the age of 10 or so, told me I was good at art, and I was just one of, you know, all of these kids doing art. But that was enough for me to decide that if the art was going to be what I was going to do. And so I really, from that point on, pretty much focused on that, and I was going to be an artist. And through that school and then on into boarding school in York, where, again, I had a supportive art teacher but not a very well-endowed art department, and was sent out, actually, to the local art school in York, probably around 15 or 16, to do life drawing classes, which was, you know, was just amazing, fantastic. Mm. Being sent out at that age to look at nude women, you know, once a week.
Sure.
Changed lots of things for me, and then I continued to focus on that. So I really didn't do particularly well at any other subjects. I put all my energy into that, and then was accepted at Central.
Okay, well, let's come much more up to date now. We left it that you'd started your film career as art director, production designer. As I've said earlier, you've actually been responsible for some 20 films at the moment. And I want to just pinpoint a couple, because I could talk about many of them. But let's just talk, first of all, about Minority Report, because I think that was a particularly important film for you. I think mainly because of its incredibly inventive digital aspect of the film. Can you tell me a little bit about how you actually arrived at some of the what's slowly becoming now a reality? I'm thinking particularly of the digital board. I don't know what I can't remember what it was called in the film. The large board that Tom Cruise stands at, yeah, and is able to look at these crimes that were to happen in the future and move things around. These things apparently are now sort of on the verge of actually happening. For you, I think we should really talk about your particular approach to production design, because you have a different take from maybe many production designers, in that I was trying to think last night of kind of an analogy, and the only thing I could come up with I think you called it, it's either immersive design or narrative design. I think you've used those two phrases. And I suddenly thought it's kind of like Stanislavskian method acting, or the sort of thing that Mike Lee does, in that you create a whole world regardless of whether it's going to be on screen or not. You actually invest in everything, a story, a backstory. And that's what you seem to be doing in your approach to production. Perhaps you'd like to, maybe I've got that a bit wrong, but perhaps you could elaborate a bit on your method of working.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Minority Report was certainly a turning point. It was a fantastic brief from Steven Spielberg, because I think I'm not that interested in fantasy, actually. I'm really, it turns out, without me having really planned it, that I'm really interested in sort of society and how societies are portrayed, and what, you know, what does it mean to have a kind of hierarchy and this kind of, you know, essentially a kind of class system in all of these different settings. And Minority Report was a perfect example of that. The brief from Stephen was that it was a near future city that had this singular condition at the center of the precogs, with a specific range, and the precogs could predict murder. So they'd created this
experiment.
These are
these strange little creatures that float around in a tank.
They float in a tank, and they are sort of extremely autistic, let's say, but they have this particular facility to be able to predict violent crime, that they have these visions. And as a result, Washington, D.C., our chosen city in the future, is this bubble of safety that people, we imagined, poured into. And all sorts of, you know, and certain conditions were set. But Minority Report, because there was no script, allowed us this notion, or in a way forced the idea that if there wasn't going to be a script, that we could get on and design the world. And it was a fascinating project. Because we waited a long time for the script to be developed, we had a long time to really think about what the conditions, what kind of world would develop within these set of rules that Stephen had set, essentially. And I think that has become more and more my process ever since, because it was really dramatically successful. In a few ways, because we had been asked to think about the film as future reality, not science fiction, and because we had been given great access to a kind of science hive mind out there, sort of access into corporations, into urban planning. And
yes, you work with scientists at MIT, I think, for the
yeah,
a lot
we
of
had a
background.
They put together a think tank, a 2-day event in Santa Monica in Los Angeles, and we sat with a dozen scientists who'd been brought together for this purpose, who'd been given the brief. There wasn't a script, as I say, but had been given the sort of context, and were really just asked to describe. They were all futurists. That's sort of a role that exists strongly in the corporate space in the US, and so they'd all been given this brief to think about the way a city might develop 50 years in the future, not specific to the script so much as contextually, what would we expect the world to look like? So that was an amazing insight, and we sat in this room until our brains hurt with all the information we were getting. And fair number of them were from MIT Media Lab, physicist Neil Gershenfeld and architect Bill Mitchell. And so we were invited to MIT to visit as a sort of second wave of information gathering, and really started seeing the cutting edge of science going on, all sorts of people doing things that are just now, or not even yet, coming to fruition. But clearly, it's real science, and at a very human scale. I mean, MIT is really interesting in that its science really is focused on social conditions and how technology changes society. And we were shown around by a young man called John Underkoffler, who was about to graduate, and it turned out he was fascinated with film and was an amazing scientist. And so I recruited him a year later. We were still working on the script and developing the world, and he came out to LA and joined the art department as a science advisor. And that really, that combination of having this very privileged access, because Steven Spielberg's name would open doors to anywhere. We could go and just say, can you tell us about this, can you tell us about that? So we were talking to people from various companies about what they were developing, and although they might not be very specific, they would tell us a lot about trends. So if talking to Apple, we might have been told that touchscreen was the next thing to happen, but we weren't going to have any access to it. But by the way, you might want to pay attention to touchscreen. And then John Underkoffler in the art department processing all of this and essentially writing scientific white papers on not yet built but imagined science objects gave us this amazing set of tools to start thinking about what might happen in the future.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And to be thinking of it in terms of really the global connection between technology and environment, and to really have an opportunity to build this world. Because what was clear was if we could get the world right and we got the logic of the world right and connect the dots, then you could set a narrative down in that space. You could basically carve a narrative or run a linear narrative through this space. And whether you turn left or right, if you go out of the door, we knew what was out that door.
Exactly.
To the left and to the right. So then as we introduced more and more ideas in this world and we pitched them one after another to Stephen, he and his writer, Scott Frank, could say, that looks like something we can work with. And so, for example, we
developed... So really, you were fundamental in building the story, which is a very unusual thing, I would have thought.
Traditionally, it's not what had happened, but it made me fundamentally question the way that we do work, that traditionally the designer works, which is, for most of the crew, a script arrives, you know...
Well, at this point, I'm producing a diagram, which is a production pipeline pie chart, which you've produced. Is this the way you work? Do you want to just describe in, you know, sort of a little bit more detail as to how it all works for you? Because it seems to me to be incredibly well organized, and you're right at the, you know, you're the second ring out, I think. So.
Well, it's a very design-centric diagram, and every other department that comes in would say, but
why are we
in that position? But of course, it's really just a way of talking about a process that we discovered during the making of Minority Report, which I would call a kind of non-linear workflow in an immersive technology-driven space. So because the technology was getting to a point where we could really prototype the design before we were building it. And that, for around this time, was called previs.
So pre-visualization.
Pre-visualization. Okay. So pre-visualization is basically allowing you to create a digital simulacrum of what it is going to be, what the film is going to be, in an animation space. So you could run characters through the space, you could put your environment assets, so all of the sets that you're going to build, while they're on the drawing board, could be put into this space digitally, built very rapidly, be a very good indication of what you were finally going to need to build physically to shoot.
So is this like a much more sophisticated version of what they used to call, I think, animatics, which they'd have for, you know, cutting films or, you know, sort of, so you can see, you can get a pretty good feeling of what you've got to build, the moves you've got to make, and so forth, so that everyone can actually be ahead of the game. really.
That's what it's for. It's a step beyond animatic. And the reason that I think it's made such a profound difference to the way that we make films is because it is packed with data. So once you've built that digital space, and animatic is really just shooting a series of storyboards. And so although it gives you a sense of pace, both basically pace and framing, it doesn't give you any richer data than that. It doesn't tell you what lens you're using, how far away the camera is from the actors, how big the actors are in space, and what's behind the actors significantly for us. With Previs, we could set up, and by the way, it's driven by animatic still, so the storyboards are still absolutely important to the process. But there comes a point where you can say, okay, we understand the sequence from the storyboards, or, and it works both ways, or here is a set, what kind of story do you want to tell in it, which is actually how Minority Report developed. Then you place a camera in an environment and start moving characters around in relation to the camera. The camera is another animated, basically an animated character also. So you've got this enormous control over what goes on in that space. And to begin with, our early process is all about testing, really. It's about scouting the location, getting to know that 3D space. Is it going to work for the story that you need to tell? What kind of stories could you tell in that space? How do you have to adapt the space and modify it for particular twists and turns in the plots and in the story? But you can use it basically to prototype all the components of the storytelling. So in Minority Report, the car, the maglev car that runs through the city, was developed as a piece of digital animation in the art department, placed in a digital environment, run through its paces, you know, how does it turn in space, how does it function, how many would fit on a road, those kind of, you know, in a way we were going through the kind of industrial design and urban planning processes that you would do in the real world. But in this case, all of this is just testing the story rather than testing something that's physically ever going to exist really in the environment. And the other thing that that is also very significant in the way that films are made now, where a big portion of the film is going to be digital, a big part of the frame could be CGI, we can continually look at the entire world, not need to make the distinction between physical and virtual, and allow the story to play out in this digital space, and then decide later how much of it you really have to build.
Do you find that there's any resistance with some directors with this kind of approach? Because it's quite a different way of working, I would have thought.
It's quite different. Film has traditionally been, one would say, linear, I guess. It's been pre-production, production, and post-production. And you'd pass the baton through the process from one head of department to another, and then your sort of influence would fall off, or your particular role would become less or more important along that line. In this non-linear space, it's very collaborative. It requires the director to make a lot more decisions a lot earlier, and so there's a resistance to that.
Do you, when you're taking on a project, do you insist that this is the way you will, the only way you will work?
I do. I think we've really tried to instill this idea that this is a very efficient production tool. Not every producer nor director has necessarily experienced it, although that's less and less true because people really do start to hear about this now, and most films have previs if they're at any scale. But it's not just using the digital tools, but of course how you use it is all important, and where it is and who uses it when. So the resistance comes, I mean, one, I think, very legitimate concern for a director is, I don't want the whole movie planned. Where, you know, I need the accident to happen on stage, for example. The actors have a huge role in what the camera does. They pull the camera to them.
For example, Terrence Malick and the
Tree of Life.
Tree of Life. A lot of the camera work in that, a lot of the on-screen stuff was actually really sort of almost improvised, from what I understand. Obviously, there's a whole lot of it that was not. But and those sort of things happen in your world?
They can, and they absolutely should. I think that people misuse and abuse these technologies at the moment through ignorance of or through a sort of, in a way, because they forget that these are just tools for making movies.
So it's not a strangle. It's not a straitjacket. It's just a really good structure. Like all good structures, there should be elbow room for creativity to move outside of them.
So we go, you know, in the terminal, there was no storyboarding. There wasn't any specific direction in any of the previs, but we did a massive amount of visualization of the space, because it allowed Steven Spielberg to become really familiar with a set that was going to cost an awful lot of money and be immovable. You know, it was an enormous set built of steel, and it wasn't going to be possible to change it once it was built.
Sure.
So we used it as a way of exploring the space so that he could be intuitive when he got there, because he knew what he was going to get.
Okay. I'd love to talk about a lot of the films. There's just one more I just want to touch on, because you're talking about space. Probably a lot of people that are not familiar with film production and production design would have thought that the second Spielberg film that you worked on, The Terminal, was actually shot at JFK, whereas in fact it was a complete set that you had built, an enormous set. I've seen a little film of you working on another watch, and I'm staggered at the sheer vastness of what you have to do and what you're in command of and the sheer number of people. It's like building a mini city, which then is broken down and you go on to the next one. I mean, that takes an enormous amount of organizational skills. And you're you seem to me, a very laid-back, relaxed person. I mean, how do you cope with the responsibility and the money involved and the schedule involved in these large productions?
The film's very hierarchical, and I think there is a very effective structure that gives everybody a powerful support system. So when I hire my keys, you know, and I've been hired as a key by the director, and then I hire the sort of second tier, the art director, the decorator, the construction coordinator, the prop master, the location manager, sort of next tier down, then they hire their team. You end up with this, you know, very effective system where there's a very large but very solid foundation for all of us. And so I can remain relaxed during most of the process of filmmaking, because I have an amazing crew of people. And because film now is this very bizarre but very effective business model where a bunch of mercenary people are out in space available. Now, we're connected to a particular project like a pop-up. We go into production, you know, 2 weeks later we're manufacturing drawings and we're in the digital space and we're working, and then a year later, you know, or during that whole process, people join and drop off, and then the film releases and the whole company shuts down and is and evaporates into thin air, and I may never work with the same team again, and very seldom do I work with anything but the very small component of my own crew again, or else you leapfrog and you come back to them, because everyone's on a different cycle.
Sure.
So we've learned to be, I think, both very adaptive and very trusting, you know, to really allow people to do their jobs to the best of their ability. And there's enormous pressure for us because we're only as good as the last job we did, and that sort of pressure, so you've got to stay at the top of your game.
When I spoke to Stuart Craig last year, I asked him a question. I said, well, what happens if the set's not ready? What happens if you haven't got it done? He said, it's always done. Is that the same?
Yeah.
It cannot.
It can never not be ready.
Yeah.
That's just, it's unimaginable. When we built our house, the idea that a deadline could slide, which happened all the time, you know, in the real world in construction, it cannot happen. It's too expensive. A shoot day costs the same as a month of my department.
Really?
So the my argument to my own team is, you know, if we can't sort everything out for a single day, you know, in a month's time, in a month, and at that scale of you know, transition from what is probably 6 months of prep, 4 to 6 months of prep for us before we start shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no, yeah, there's no option.
No,
absolutely.
Okay, a few more things before we end, but one of which is last year you designed, I think, your very first opera called Death and the Power. That's quite a departure. How did that come about? And do you intend to do more of that sort of thing?
Well, Death and the Powers came about directly from Minority Report, actually, or perhaps indirectly, because John Underkoffler was called 10 years later by Todd Machover, who was professor at MIT Media Lab and ran the Opera of the Future Lab, and asked him to recommend a designer because he was looking for somebody to do this opera. And it resulted in me becoming a visiting artist at MIT for about 5 years, going through two or three generations of students, developing this opera as a series of projects for the lab that were all going to end up in a performance.
Right.
It was commissioned by a group in Monte Carlo, mm-hmm. and written by the ex-poet laureate, the Clinton-era poet laureate, and a fantastic theatre director and great choreographer and an opera, you know, fantastic composer. But it was a very, very unique situation because we had science and Hollywood and Broadway and independent theatre all colliding, you know, a lot of the time. Mm. But it was an absolutely wonderful experience.
It got very good reviews as well. I read a few on
it did,
online.
Yeah. It did
and
really
it looked
well.
Pretty spectacular, I have to say.
And it was, you know, there were a lot of robots on stage. There was a lot of really complex technology going on. The sound space alone was completely cutting edge, you know, hundreds of speakers, immersive sound system with pinpointing sound, specific sound in space.
Sort of three-dimensional.
Three-dimensional sound connecting to a very sophisticated visual system that was being driven by measured performance so that the lead character goes off stage at the beginning of the piece and never comes back. And his breath and timbre of his voice and his position of his arms was driving robotics
really?
And visuals
wow.
on stage. So a very direct correlation, one-to-one correlation between live performance and sort of delivery system.
Well, let's talk a little bit about now.
So I do want to do more, basically.
You do, yes. Well, it's. I thought it was quite a departure for you, but now I can understand the context, which leads me on to your activities with 5D. Can you elaborate on that? What is 5D?
5D came about because we realized that as we were using more and more technology in the art department, that we were using technology that was being shared by lots of other aspects of narrative media, and that we had found kind of a common thread between all of these different media spaces through design. That the one place that was really common to film, animation, TV, theater, architecture, interactive media, game, experience design, theme parks, if you separate out all of the roles in those different silos, the one consistent role that occurs and appears over and over again throughout all of this narrative media is the designer. And we're now all using the same tool sets. So as we started to talk to one another, we realized we all have just a little tiny piece of the pie.
Yeah.
The interactive media was all about real time. We were in film all about story. But if you bring real time game engines, so the ability to have instant feedback from the space that you're designing, and you mash that together with story, you basically come up with a fantastic visualization system.
You call this collaborative world building.
Yes, it's taking the notion of what we've learned with Minority Report, the idea that all of those different narrative spaces, from architecture to game to film, all basically start with the idea of building a world. And in fact, particularly because there's not a linear narrative in the game space or in the theme park space, for example, you're much more focused on the power of the ability for the environment to be embedded with narrative or to convey narrative. And how do you tell stories with space, or how do you trigger storytelling through environment is the common ground. And so by what 5D has done is, I think, effectively created a very strong interdisciplinary area for conversation.
And you're a founding member, partner.
Yes, I'm the
organizer. And you're the founder, in fact. And you have conferences and events and so forth, and which has developed quite a lot over the last couple of years. Is that something you intend to give a lot more time to?
It's really an intriguing space to be in, and I'm really engaged and enjoying what's happening in these interdisciplinary kind of cross-media collaborations. Mm. And so, yes, I think 5D is really now evolving into something between a kind of consultancy and a design studio and a sort of narrative space of its own. And we're getting a lot of interest from corporate world and from academia, actually, both those spaces and the industries themselves, to just start evolving or applying some of the best practices that we've learned out of doing this now for 10 years or more, to building worlds that can convey brands or can convey society, can convey a way of looking at the future in all sorts of different spaces. And so I think in some ways film is at a slightly, you know, it's a conservative industry, and it's a little bit at a crossroads now. It's possible to use technology to make really interesting narratives, but it may not be that film is the only space that, you know, I think you can tell really interesting stories in a lot of different spaces now, from the e-book to media-based architecture.
Well, going back briefly now to that more traditional and conventional space, filmmaking. You were here in London to kick off the pre-production for a new film, which was going to carry on for quite a long time. You're going to be here until December or late December, and you find suddenly that the film has been, has the rug's been pulled from under you. Does this sort of thing happen often in your world?
It's unfortunately all too common that we, you know, in a way it's its own kind of prototyping, but film, the early stages of film do involve the designer, and very often one gets involved in developing the story space before there's an actor attached, or before the script is completed, or maybe before it's even started, without a real knowledge of what it's going to cost when you bring all those components together. And a lot of our job is developing the real conditions, you know, to be able to say to the studio, to the director, to the producers, with what you're asking for with this script, this is likely to be how long it's going to take to film, this is how much it's going to cost, this is where we're going to have to shoot, this is where the script is not working, this is the kind, you know. So the part of the process at the early stages, it has a lot to do with investigating how viable it is to make a film. It's very unusual in the case of this film to go as far, to be so far along the line, to be building sets as we are, and to have the film shut down. And I think it suggests, actually, more and more to me, that there are better ways of thinking about how you produce a new product. We're making vehicle, you know, we're making cars, really. I mean, we're in a production line kind of a space, but what we're producing is driven entirely by the imagination. We're producing things that are abstract, you know, it's ideas brought into actualization, into fruition. But the real energy and interest that I find in this prototyping space is that you can actualize ideas. You can really create a tangible evidence of whether or not this particular idea is going to work. And you can do it early enough that if one pays proper attention, you really can tell whether an idea is viable before you spend a great deal of money.
So in all of those 20 films that you've made, which of those would you say really stands up to your personal view of how films should be made using your particular philosophy?
Well, I think there are so many aspects of what makes a film work, and one of those is, or quite a lot of that is beyond my control.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
Great deal of it's beyond my control. Yeah. But, you know, Fight Club was, to me, where it started, this idea, and it was because there's a powerful and incredibly strong imaginative director
at
the helm, David Fincher, who just wants control, you know, and that's really where all of this stems from, is if we... You know, so we used previs extensively in Fight Club, and it was the first time it was used in the art department, because we went in and basically appropriated it. We took it because it was being used for visual effects, and that for him to be able to control what was going to happen in post. And we went in and said, actually, that looks like a really good tool for us to give us some of that. And so Fight Club, I think, was very effective. I think Minority Report was very effective. There's no question that it was made, you know, for a number, and for the, you know, it was made on budget, and it was done effectively, and it got to explore all these ideas, and a lot of the storytelling came about after the world was built and was called from the world back into the script. And that seemed really effective, that transaction. And Minority Report led into, you know, because Spielberg trusted the process at that point, with The Terminal, we really got the opportunity to use it very thoroughly. So I think The Terminal worked very well. More recently, I mean, I've done a couple of independent films and a big studio film, Watchmen, which I think used that throughout. And we really planned down to the tiniest detail, and it produced a very effective process. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the same thing, very good core crew where the collaboration worked very well and there was the opportunity for everyone to collaborate around a digital space. Mm-hmm. We've just finished Man of Steel, Superman, and not only prototyping in the digital space, but actually creating rapid prototype sets. In Man of Steel, we get to actually design Krypton. Much more of Krypton is on film.
Rather than those rather Bako foil early versions.
Somewhat, yes. I mean, I actually quite like the 1, 2, and 3 Krypton. But we said
it looked like a set of Doctor Who, I always thought. But it's anyway, the very first one.
But there's no crystals, you know. Yeah. And what we decided, and we evolved a very rich and very fully developed world for Krypton. But what we said was that it had emerged out of a kind of where biology was the principal science, and that the organic was really important. And so we applied a kind of design thinking that would imagine that all of the architecture, the spaceships, the props, the objects are all basically had evolved, that had a certain kind of organic intelligence, and there were no straight lines in Krypton, and they never actually just invented or discovered the straight line.
Hence the organic bit. Okay.
Yeah. So we did rapid. So we basically rapid prototyped an enormous amount of it.
I always end with a simple question, which is, what pearls of wisdom would you pass on to any aspiring young designer who wanted to go into the same field as you? What do you have to say about that?
I think it's the most interesting time to be entering a field that is actually really not yet defined. I mean, I think that I started my career as a production designer from day one by accident. I never knew anything else. And through the music videos and the commercials and the movies, we've evolved a certain practice, but we never had the perspective that one has now. The teaching was archaic. There was no real teaching for design. Now we have a space, the potential for designing and applying a kind of practice that would... We now have the means to apply design to a very broad range of different kinds of media. We're moving into this area that might be called transmedia, where a story can evolve simultaneously as a comic book and as a movie and as a TV show and as a stage play and as a game. And really the we don't yet know what the implication of that is going to be, but the chances are that stories are going to be told across multiple platforms at the same time. So I think the next generation of designers have to really open their minds. I mean, you've got to question everything, don't take anything for granted, be, you know, extremely curious, but and have the expectation that the imagination can be conjured into something tangible. There's no limit to what can be made. There's no sort of physical restrictions. The only restrictions now is the imagination. And I think a lot of that requires a different business model. I think part of what also has to happen is that the next generation has to really be open to the idea that what we know from the last century may not necessarily apply for the next century, and that those traditional processes, some of the thinking, some of the process that's evolved in the past 100 years is fantastically applicable, but mostly the new sets of tools just give us bigger freedom to let the imagination come to life. So it's a matter of just sort of diving in now and seeing what happens.
Well, you've painted a very exciting landscape ahead. Alex Madel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.